My guest today, Alfred W. McCoy, is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, having previously studied Southeast Asian history at Yale University. In 1971, he was commissioned to write a book on the opium trade in Laos and discovered the French equivalent of the CIA had financed all its covert operations from the control of the Indochina drug trade. He also found evidence that after the U.S. replaced the French, the CIA took over the drug trade, and after attempts by the CIA to block his publication of his book, The Politics of Heroin, it was published in 1972, and now in a third revised edition, it has been translated into 9 languages. Professor McCoy has spent the past 30 years writing about Southeast Asian history and politics. Among his books is A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, published in 2006, and Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State in 2009, and most recently his article Surveillance Blowback, The Making of the U.S. Surveillance State, 1898-2020, which appeared online at Tom Dispatch. That's what we'll be talking about today. Welcome, Professor Alfred McCoy, to Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, we learned today that Edward Snowden has been allowed to leave the Russian airport where he can begin taking steps to seek asylum someplace else, presumably Venezuela. You've traced more than a century of U.S. surveillance strategies from what we would now consider primitive to high tech. What impact, if any, do you think Snowden's revelations will have on the course of Washington's future surveillance strategies?
Well, it calls the question. Over 100 years ago, Mark Twain put forward a very simple proposition when he wrote about the U.S. conquest and colonization of the Philippines. He said that by trampling on the rights of the helpless abroad, the American people learned the apathy to endure the like at home. In short, Twain argued that we couldn't have empire abroad and democracy at home. And now that Edward Snowden has revealed to us the incredible extent of NSA surveillance that the NSA, the National Security Agency, has effectively established an American domestic surveillance state, and indeed is working hard to build a global surveillance apparatus. So the question is called, the U.S. Congress right now has before it an amendment to our defense appropriation by Representative Justin Amash, A-M-A-S-H, of Michigan, which is, I think, going to be voted on by the House of Representatives today in Washington, or perhaps tomorrow, but it's supposed to be up for today. And he's trying to cut off all funding for NSA collection of phone calls and emails by American citizens unless there's a specific warrant. In other words, he's trying to stop the NSA from doing what it's been doing, really, since the start of the War on Terror, which is basically collecting all of the phone calls and emails of every American. The White House has denounced this as weakening our national security. Your senator, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she's denounced this. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has just a few hours ago released a memo urging the House of Representatives to pass this amendment. So the question has been called.
What was interesting was that initially after the revelations that the polls that I heard seemed to think that most Americans were apathetic, as Mark Twain had predicted, that there was not the outrage by a large segment of the public about what the government was doing, even the old statement, if you're not doing anything wrong, why worry about it? And we've seen this kind of atmosphere. We had church hearings back in the 70s in which we had, which was attempt to actually change, to get rid of COINTELPRO, some of the surveillance and counterintelligence techniques and operations the government was using. But we don't seem to have any significant numbers of members of Congress. The member you mentioned in Michigan is not very well known publicly. He happens to be a Palestinian American and Muslim, Tea Party Republican, ironically. But we don't really see that kind of anger against this that we saw back in the 70s. And the mainstream media seems more preoccupied with talking about Edward Snowden and where he's going to go and whether he's a criminal or not than actually what the revelations were.
Sure. I think the difference between the 70s and now is that back in the 1970s, it was revealed that during our involvement in the Vietnam War, the FBI and the CIA were conducting massive counterintelligence and surveillance of the anti-war protesters, which represented a significant segment of American society. They were essentially the baby boom generation, the biggest generation in American history. In 1974, the famous investigative reporter Seymour Hersh published an article in the New York Times saying that the CIA was running an illegal operation, Operation Chaos, that in violation of the CIA's charter was conducting domestic surveillance of the anti-war protest movement here in the United States. That led, of course, as you mentioned, Senator Frank Church's very famous investigative committee, the Church Committee, to look into both Operation Chaos by the CIA and then the FBI's long-running counterintelligence program, discovering that, first of all, that the CIA's operation, which had a database, computer database with about 300,000 names in it, was completely illegal, and that, second, that the FBI's counterintelligence operations were using illegal tactics that were a violation of democratic principles to harass both the African-American civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam protest movement. And because these were both significant sectors of American society, African-Americans about 12 to 13% of all the American people, and the protesters were a very large baby boom generation, Congress acted, and what they did was they ratcheted back the establishment of a permanent surveillance state by creating the so-called FISA courts, requiring that any time a government agency wanted to do wiretapping inside the United States, they had to get a warrant from this special FISA court. All right. And so that represented a kind of substantial reform. And that was a continuation of a pattern that actually we've seen in the United States operating from the 1890s, if I could just place that in context, okay? And then come to the present and show what's changed and why we're in a very different circumstance and why Snowden's revelations are so important. Look, the origins of U.S. surveillance capacity, the capacity of the federal government to conduct surveillance of American citizens, dates back to the late 19th century. The United States came up with a synergy of brilliant innovations in data management. But the federal government, because of Constitution and the courts, had really no enforcement capacity beyond the customs barrier. And so when we intervened in the Philippines in 1898, we were suddenly in very new terrain. The U.S. Army was plunged into the pacification of a dense, hostile Asian society that had just conducted two generations of political mobilization and launched the first national revolution in Asia that had defeated 300 years of Spanish colonial rule. And we were faced with the pacification of this insurgent republic. We had a very powerful army. We could smash anything, but we didn't know where to strike or how to strike. And so the U.S. Army created, in 1901, the first field intelligence unit in its 100-year history. And it placed in charge of that unit a man named Captain Ralph Van Diemen. He developed very sophisticated counterintelligence techniques. He did a kind of map of the entire Philippine political elite, collecting amazingly detailed data on thousands of Filipino political leaders. And then the U.S. Army Signal Corps laced the archipelago with 10,000 miles of telegraph wires, allowing for the instantaneous transmission of this sophisticated intelligence data. Moreover, the first U.S. colonial governor of the Philippines, William Howard Taft, created a colonial police force called the Philippines Constabulary that applied these very sophisticated counterintelligence penetration techniques to pacifying the Philippines. So by 1907, the combination of the Army's intelligence and this colonial police had pacified the country. Well, 10 years later, the United States joined World War I, and we were the only army on either side of the battle lines in World War I that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. So the U.S. Army, in April 1917, established the Military Intelligence Division, and they appointed Captain, now Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, to be the founder of U.S. Army Military Intelligence, indeed U.S. Internal Security. And he applied his Philippine experience, his rich, detailed Philippine experience, to constructing a counterintelligence apparatus in the United States. And very quickly, Military Intelligence Division grew from one employee himself to 1,700. And then he worked with the FBI, which had been recently established. And together they formed an alliance with a civilian group called the American Protective League, which had 350,000 badge-carrying civilian agents, counterintelligence agents. And they conducted the most massive surveillance of any society to date in human history. And after the war was over, the FBI and military intelligence, working with its kind of citizen vigilantes, conducted the notorious Luster raids in New York City, the Palmer raids across the northeastern United States, and they smashed strikes by the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, from New York Harbor all the way to Seattle. And the abuses were so extraordinary that when Republicans came into power in 1921, because all of this had been done under a liberal Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, so when the Republicans came into power, they were concerned about privacy. The Republican Attorney General, Harlan Fiske Stone, in 1924 said that a secret police is a potential danger to a free society, and he forced the FBI to cut all of its ties to citizen vigilante groups, and he proclaimed that the FBI was no longer interested in the political beliefs of any American, whatever they might be. And famously, 5 years later, in 1929, a Republican who was serving as Secretary of War, Henry L. Stimson, abolished the cipher, the kind of code-breaking section of the Military Intelligence Division, saying, gentlemen, do not read each other's mail. Okay, so what we saw is a pattern established. In time of war, internal security expanded. When peacetide comes, through the partisan process, the opposite party cuts back on the surveillance apparatus radically, sharply, preventing the establishment of a standing or permanent surveillance state. That's the same pattern we saw during the Vietnam era. Massive expansion in internal surveillance by FBI and CIA during the 1960s, the era of the Vietnam protests, particularly under Republican conservative President Richard Nixon. But then in the 1970s, as the Vietnam War came to an end, Democrats, the opposite party, in a partisan process, ratchet back the surveillance state. Now, that pattern continued right after 9/11. President Bush illegally allowed the National Security Agency, the NSA, to start conducting systematic surveillance of Americans. They decided that metadata, the kind of stuff at the top of your email message, was not constitutionally protected, and therefore they allowed the NSA to start collecting metadata of all emails. The FBI built very quickly something called the Investigative Data Warehouse that had over 1 billion messages in it within 5 years. This was pretty systematic surveillance. Okay, it was exposed by the New York Times in 2005. It was exposed by USA Today in an important investigative article in 2006. So when President Obama came into office, he was fully aware of the extent and the abuse, the illegality of things that had been done under President Bush. But he broke the partisan pattern. Instead of ratcheting back, cutting back on the surveillance that was done under his Republican predecessor, Obama has decided to make cyber surveillance and cyber warfare the centerpiece of a new defense posture. And so he's built upon the Bush surveillance, and he's begun building through the NSA a global surveillance apparatus, which is a kind of agile, low-cost vehicle for the perpetuation of U.S. global hegemony.
What you have described in this article prints out 10 pages. It's a remarkable history, as I say, going back to the Philippines and the development of new technologies that enabled the surveillance state to begin. It's a very scary scenario, and even though whatever Congress seems to do, there seems to be a limit on what they will be allowed to even know or speak about publicly.
Right. Let me. You said it's a frightening scenario, but I don't think it's overstated. 4 years ago, also writing in Time Dispatch, drawing upon my book, Policing America's Empire, I said, look, Let's look at the long trajectory of U.S. history. Look at this pattern I just described of expansion of surveillance during wartime, and then when the rival party comes back into power after the war is over, ratcheting back on the surveillance apparatus. Okay, and in 2009, I said, okay, it was the start of the Obama administration. Back in 2009, I said, we are just a few tweaks away from developing a domestic surveillance state in the United States. I said, you know, we're almost there. It could happen.
And you were right.
I was right. In other words, and historians actually, I think, have a terrible track record, okay, in using history to, you know, using the past to predict the future. But, you know, if you do it right, if you look at the sort of trajectory, the overarching trajectory, not the details, nobody can do that. You can see trends, and you can see the shape of the trends and where we're heading, all right? That allows you to sort through all the kind of noise of the daily press, all the sensationalism, you know, all the usual stuff that we get in our media, and to look for longer-term trends. And this larger history that I just described to you, that allows us to see the trajectory. Okay? And I think now that if you look at the situation we're in, that Congress's capacity to cut this back, I think, is fairly limited. Let me explain. In 2012, when President Obama came out with his defense budget, this was a point where he'd been in office long enough where he understood things, where he could really begin to take control. He could see the shape of the future. All right, and as we all know, many of the attributes of U.S. global power that have existed for the past 50 years are beginning to wane. You know, back in 1950, we had something like half of world trade under our control. You know, China is on the edge of passing us as the world's number one economic power. The World Bank predicts by 2016, China will have about 18% of world trade, and we'll have just 17%. We'll become the number two world power, okay? So clearly, although our absolute economic strength is still quite impressive, relatively, we presided over an era, half century, of global growth. You could say it's a complement to U.S. global power, okay, that we've been able to do this. Well, nonetheless, our relative power is waning. So how do we maintain our world leadership? President Obama has cut back in his 2012 defense budget infantry by 14%. He's cutting back on all the conventional heavy metal weaponry, the aircraft, the tanks, the trucks, the destroyers, the cruisers, all the rest of it. And what he's doing is he's moving us, if you read his budget, into an era of cyber warfare and space warfare. And he's building a new agile global apparatus, low cost, for the perpetuation of U.S. global power. In 2009, Obama established the U.S. Cyber Command, right, which declared cyberspace to be a domain of military conflict, just like air, land, and sea. And he established the U.S. Cyber Command, and he appointed as the head of the U.S. Cyber Command General Keith Alexander, who's concurrently, of course, the head of the NSA, the man who's been was walking around Congress yesterday lobbying intensely for against the amendment by Representative Amash of Michigan, trying to stop Congress from cutting back NSA's right to unchecked surveillance. This is more power in the hands of a single man than anybody has ever had before. So look, the NSA, simultaneously under its very operations, working with its counterpart British intelligence, has begun tapping into fiber optic cables all across the United States. And then its counterpart agency in the UK, the Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, starting in 2011, in a project launched jointly with the NSA, sank 200 probes into the transatlantic cables and began harvesting 600 messages a month. In March of this year, the NSA is believed to have harvested 97 billion messages. That's over a trillion messages a year from the United States and around the world. The fiber optic cables, because all of our communications, telephone and email, all of our communications, text and voice, now go through these fiber optic cables. It's an amazing centralization of all human communication. So by sinking probes into just a few thousand cables, you can basically scoop up the world's communications, all right? That's what NSA is doing. Simultaneously, the Obama administration has created a brand new headquarters constructed at the cost of nearly $2 billion for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency that's monitoring all the communications in the skies above. So it's kind of NSA tapping into the fiber optic cables in the ground below while the NGIA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, is developing an apparatus to surveil all the communications in the skies above. The Obama administration has been building and launching a flotilla of 99 Global Hawk drones. Now, these are not like the Reapers and Predators that are armed with missiles that are really kind of combat-oriented. The Global Hawk is a surveillance drone that has continuous 20-hour flight and can take, very sharp images for a 100-mile radius and, more importantly for our purposes, suck up all audio communications, two-way radios, local cell phone towers, stuff that's going from a cell phone to a tower. It can scoop that up for a 100-mile radius. So we're developing a comprehensive apparatus. Simultaneously, the Air Force has launched the world's first space drone, the X-37B, which has been successfully tested since April 2010. And it can carry missiles to knock out any rival global telecommunications satellite system. Most of the U.S. military command, control, and communications goes through satellites. And we have had, for the better part of 60 years, the world a monopoly on satellite communications. We have the world's only global satellite system. China, by 2020, will have the world's second satellite system. And in 2007, China conducted an experiment. They shot a missile up, and they knocked out one of their own orbiting satellites. So the age of space warfare has arrived. So the combination of NSA monitoring the fiber optic cables and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, along with the Air Force, monitoring all sort of surface communications, means that we have built or are on the edge of completing the world's first truly global surveillance apparatus.
Well, from what you're saying, there is nothing that Congress is about to do or going to do that is going to even put more than a blip in the road of this operation. It sounds that it is so enormous and so many people are involved in it, so much money has already been spent on it, that whatever legislation Congress passes will hardly even trip it up for a moment. That we are beyond even coping with this at this particular time.
Well, the thing is, we now are at a unique historical moment. Edward Snowden has put the issue on the front pages of the paper. Those NSA slides that the Washington Post has published, any American can go and look at those slides and see the scope and the scale of this domestic surveillance, right? And I think the ACLU is very well aware that this is not just passive. It's not just a question, well, we have nothing to hide. My phone calls to my family, my visa bills, so what if they're monitoring that? All of us live, responsible, legal lives. So why should we be worried? Well, they're not worried about that. They're worried about deviance of any sort. And we've seen that the American state, like all states, has a tendency to consider any form of challenge to its authority to be deviance. I mean, we've seen the IRS has been monitoring or slowing the applications for the various Tea Party affiliates. We know that environmental activists are under fairly strict surveillance with their mail being monitored. All right, so basically anybody that is going to challenge and exercise their constitutional rights and become an activist that's going to challenge the current dispensation anyway, faces the risk of harassment. This stuff is not benign. It's just not. It's used against anybody, left, center, or right, who's going to be in any way politically active. And it's that very small percentage of the population, all right, that are going to be subjected to the harassment that the power of the and the power that this surveillance allows. You know, let's we forget, J. Edgar Hoover, all right, for 30 years, right, protected his bureau, the FBI, from any meaningful legislative or congressional oversight because Hoover had his private files where he had all of the financial and sexual derelictions of influential Americans on the file, and nobody dared challenge him. All right, so this stuff is never benign. All right, it's used selectively to target those that are politically active. And without these activists, okay, without people like Reverend Martin Luther King, who was, by the way, subject to intensive FBI surveillance and had lots of incriminating information collected about him, without people like Martin Luther King, you know, think about what King represented, the movement that he led, the change that made in the quality of American life, absolutely critical. Well, you know, government wasn't doing that by itself. It was a movement. Movements for change always are the way that the American people express their political will. Well, with this surveillance capacity, the state can actually cripple the capacity of the civil society and ordinary citizens to change the direction of their government. And the American state will not prosper.
Some people say, well, with all this information and billions and trillions of emails, documents, phone messages, and so on, they can't possibly go through all this material, but obviously they have material.
Absolutely.
They can do it.
They can do it because in 2006, as the FBI and the NSA were beginning to collect, you know, what were billions of messages, they were overwhelmed, right? And so President Bush launched a special project in 2006 to harness the IBM supercomputers, these super fast, super powerful computers, to develop the sorting and processing programs that could, in fact, you know, sort 97 billion emails as easily as you and I can find an email to our mother on our own personal computers. They can do it now, okay, because of this project. So they can not only suck up a trillion messages a year, but they can process them agilely so that if they decide that, for example, you, because you're saying some things they don't like on your radio show, well, they can go through your financial communications. They can go through your private communications. They can acquire information to harass you as they see fit. Okay, I mean, take myself, okay? I've been, you know, somebody who writes about national security issues. I've been critical of the Bush administration's policy on torture. I've been critical of the Obama administration's policy of continuing much of the Bush policy on torture through rendition and through turning a blind eye to the abuses of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Okay, so I'm a critic of the of both Republicans and Democrats, and I discovered earlier in the year my phone went dead in my office, so I called a technician, and he came in, and he said, "Oh, your wire's been cut." He said, "I went down to the board in the building." I said, "How many wires are there?" He said, "There are hundreds." And he said, "Your wire had been cut." I said, "Was it a clean cut? Was it a snip?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, okay, that's clear. Somebody put a listening device on it because through the university switchboard, a university of 50,000 people, they can't track an individual line. They had to get in there and get a monitoring device. And when they took it off, they didn't know how to repair the wire." I was coming back from a conference at the Surveillance Studies Center at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario last month. And I was selected out of the line. I'd cleared security in Canada, all right? But as I was boarding my Madison flight, suddenly the TSA selected me. I'd never been selected before, okay? I mean, you know, and I was patted down. They went through my bag, my luggage, right there, you know, in the boarding area. And, of course, I got an IRS audit. You know, I mean, that's a surprise. My phone's tapped. I'm selected by the TSA, and I got an IRS audit. I mean, I'm a person of no consequence. I'm a very minor voice, and yet they're going after me. So, in other words, it's not benign. Okay?
Well, you've been one of the most important critics of this system, and they were sending you a message, I'm sure, to be quiet.
Yeah, to be quiet. Just go home, you know, go shopping, you know, be quiet, right? You know, that we got you, and we're going to, you know, we're going to make life a little uncomfortable for you to try and make you quiet. And that's what they did to the Tea Party movement. So it's right across the political spectrum. All right? And if a society that stills dissent, okay, that stills critics, is a society that doesn't doesn't change, doesn't adapt, as all societies and their governments must do continuously. I would argue that that using this apparatus, and it will be used, right, allowing this accretion of power, allowing this apparatus to exist, allowing it to operate without any functional oversight, and there is no oversight, okay, is a potential risk. As Harlan Fiske said back in 1924, a secret police is a potential threat to a free society. And that remains as true today as it was back in 1924.
Well, this interesting Colonel finally, Brigadier General von Daemon, would look back on what he has achieved with a big smile on his face. You say he is the father of military intelligence, and most Americans have never heard his name.
Right. And actually, he's also, interestingly enough, the father of the American blacklist, because as I explained, when the system he ran in the Philippines was used politically, all right, as I said, it's not benign. Under William Howard Taft and Captain Van Diemen, that intelligence apparatus did two things. First of all, it not only monitored the political activities of Filipinos in all discourse, in all public space, press, and public speech, okay, but it penetrated the homes. It collected all kinds of incriminating information about the two things, of course, that such incriminating information always has, sex, sexual peccadilloes, and financial malfeasance. Now, those that were sympathetic to the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes buried within the files of the U.S. colonial security apparatus. Those who were critics of the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes released to the press and their reputations destroyed. That's the way the system operates. And that's the risk to any democracy, that massive amounts of information, all right, can be used against individual critics.
And it has been used domestically in terms of blackmail. I know a couple of cases of members of Congress who would otherwise take different positions, but if I know something about them, certainly the government knows about them as well.
Well, let's go back to Van Diemen. He retired as a major general from the U.S. Army in 1929. And he retired to San Diego and bought himself a nice, comfortable bungalow. And he and his wife was quite a formidable woman. She was the first woman to ever fly on an aircraft. They set up a private intelligence service because, as I explained earlier, that during the 1920s, Congress and the courts had cut back on the domestic surveillance apparatus. So Van Diemen filled that void, and he ran a kind of private exchange service of intelligence between the Red Squads in San Diego and Los Angeles, in the city police, Office of Naval Intelligence, U.S. Army Military Intelligence, and then business associations had their own intelligence services. And he assembled all this information. He compiled dossiers on 250,000 Americans, particularly those in Hollywood, suspected of subversion. And he served as an informal conduit, moving incriminating information from classified government files into the hands of anti-communist activists who would blacklist people. And it's believed, for example, in 1950, when Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas ran against Congressman Richard Nixon for the Senate seat from the state of California, Van Diemen is believed, and his files are believed to have been the source of the so-called pink sheets that Nixon circulated as rallies, implicating or implying that Helen Gahagan Douglas was a communist or a communist sympathizer, that she was pink. And that, of course, played a critical role in Nixon's electoral victory in 1950, putting him on a path to presidency of the United States.
I remember that well, because I lived in Southern California then, and I remember they had red channels. It was amazing, the collaboration between the state Internal Security Committee. They had like a state HUAC. I guess it was people like Van Diemen.
Van Diemen worked very closely with State Senator Tenney.
Jack Tenney.
Right, Jack Tenney, who was the longtime head of that committee, targeting people through the blacklisting of the reports, the official reports that the California state legislature would execute, denouncing a number of people as Hollywood luminaries by the dozens. as communist sympathizer.
Professor McCoy, we're coming to the end of a very informative hour, and there is so much to be told. I want to make sure all the listeners know about this article you've written that's on Tom Dispatch. It's called Surveillance Blowback, The Making of the U.S. Surveillance State, 1898 to 2020. If you Google Surveillance Blowback, you should get this article. It's 10 pages printed out. It's all meat, no chaff. It's frightening, but it's something I think every American, every person needs to know in order to combat this and bring it to the attention of your public officials. Professor McCoy, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and doing the work that you've been doing.
Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And to you.